Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Bear Stearns bailout? Check. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac bailout? Check. Lehman Brothers? Let me get back to you on that one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 9th of September. It's Tuesday, and it is good to have you here. Stop me if you've heard this one before, but there is a big piece of the global financial system that's run into some trouble. And if things keep going the way they have been, Lehman Brothers is going to need help from somebody. Shares fell almost 45% today as investors worried that the Wall Street Bank simply doesn't have enough money in its bank. There had been some on-again, off-again talk that a South Korean institution was looking to invest. That talk is off again as of today. So speculation's turning to other ways Lehman might work itself through its cash crunch. And that's where the analogy to Bear Stearns and Fannie and Freddie come in. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Lehman Brothers looks more like a damsel in distress every day. It's written down more than $8 billion. Its stock has fallen more than 80% since last year. And last quarter, Lehman lost around $1 billion a month.
They need to raise capital.
Hugh Johnson is chief economist with Johnson Illington Advisors. He says Lehman's best shot is to sell off some of its crown jewels, like asset management division Neuberger Berman.
The best outcome for Lehman would be to be able to sell parts of Lehman at an amount that will inject enough capital to offset the losses that they're going to have to take in writing down these bad assets to turn the corner and become profitable.
A number of foreign and domestic companies are sniffing around Lehman's good assets, but if the brokerage can't turn the corner on its own, Uncle Sam could step in. Not everybody thinks that's the best course of action, but Ken Thomas with the Wharton School of Business says there's no question it would happen.
The precedent has been set with Bear Stearns. Lehman has equally important interconnections throughout the system. They're involved with so many different other companies. It's assumed that the government will step in.
If the government let Lehman fail, it could be disastrous for the U.S. financial system, says economist Hugh Johnson. Investors could respond by dumping shares in U.S. investment banks. Those banks would stop lending, and the economy would grind to a halt. Lehman reports quarterly results next week. Investors expect it will have some kind of survival plan in place by then. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The last time oil prices were this low, it was April Fool's Day, believe it or not. It seemed like a bad joke when prices were on the way up. But all kidding aside, crude dropped another $3 today. Hurricane Ike changed course, and OPEC's probably not going to cut production. Clearly, though, a couple of months of $4 a gallon gas have taken their toll on American commuters. A mass transit group says public transportation ridership was up 5% this spring over a year ago. Congress has certainly noticed. Today, the Senate Banking Committee took up new transit funding. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer how long public transportation might stay this hot.
Metro transit agencies used to have to run ads to attract riders.
Metro buses riding through town, saving more and more people from being held up at the pump.
There's no need to advertise now. The American Public Transportation Association says riders made almost 3 billion trips this spring on public transportation. Association Vice President Rose Sheridan says the extra riders are welcome, but also a strain for transit agencies.
There are about 85% of them are reporting capacity problems.
At Metro Transit in Madison, Wisconsin, schedule planner Colin Kahn has his hands full.
we used to send out extra buses, maybe 10 or 15 every morning to help overloaded trips. Now we're sending out upwards of 40 during the morning rush hour.
Congress is now considering bills that would boost public transportation funding by about $2 billion. MIT transportation analyst Frederick Salvucci says this is the time to shift people to buses and trains permanently.
Kind of what they used to call in Sunday school the teachable moment. There's an outside issue, in this case gasoline prices, that gets people's attention focused on an issue.
But what if gas prices fall? Salvucci says people won't go back to their cars if they have a smooth ride on public transit.
That's why I think it's so important for the government to step in now and help and not wait until next year.
Congress is promising to act before the November elections. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Retailers have been taking a big hit as consumer spending has slowed with a down economy. Even though discounters have generally been able to hold their own, Target is trying something new. The chain is going to open 4 stores in Manhattan this Friday, but they're not going to be your usual airplane hanger-sized deal stocked with frying pans, basketball shorts, and, I don't know, baby lotion. They're designer boutiques, and they'll be here and gone faster than you could say catwalk. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York.
They're called Bullseye Bodegas, named after Target's Bullseye logo and New York's famous corner stores. I went into one on 57th Street. Even though it's not open yet, the PR guy, Joshua Thomas, is there, which gives you a sense of what this is all about.
Really, the idea behind it is an in-and-out strategy, put up a store, take it down in a number of days, and really generate buzz and excitement.
That seems to be working. Every couple minutes, a customer tries to get in and buy some of the clothes and accessories created for Target by high-end designers. Manuel Cristobal says he'll be back when this bodega opens on Friday.
Yes, definitely I'll be here.
What will you be looking for?
Just to check out what we have, because I'm always looking for something that I don't need, but it sounds very cool.
Target doesn't have any of its traditional mega stores in New York City, and that's not surprising given the price of real estate. But the company hopes these bodegas will drive traffic to those big stores and to Target's website. Retail analyst Howard Davidowitz says Target's cheap chic strategy is a smart one.
It's a very powerful fashion message at a price, and that's what Target stands for. That's why we call them Target.
Davidowitz says shoppers who cut back during tough economic times still want to feel like they can afford some luxury.
The consumer is willing to buy something if they think it's the right deal, the right merchandise, the right time, the right place, at the right price.
Makes you wonder, then, why Target is bothering to close the bodegas next week. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
This news flash from San Francisco, Apple's Steve Jobs is still very much alive. Despite some still unresolved concerns about his health, the Apple CEO did his standard blue jeans and black turtleneck thing at a product announcement for new iPods today. Investors, though, didn't think so highly of the company's stock. Apple lost 3.9%. The major indices not too far behind that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Henry Paulson, that son of a gun, cost me more than $400 yesterday. Just reached right into my retirement account and took it. Not literally, of course, but he might as well have. As we told you yesterday, his decision to have the government take over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac sent stock investors running for the door. The two companies' share prices dropped about 80%. And after we got off the air yesterday, I got to wondering whether my retirement funds had any Fannie or Freddie in them. 10 minutes and some online research later, I discovered my account was $447 worse off than when the day began. That, in turn, prompted me to ask Tess Viglin to come by and talk about how many others might be in the same boat. Hi, Tess.
Hello, Kai. Boy, that buys a lot of diapers, doesn't it?
$447. I mean, you got to be kidding me. But obviously, I'm not the only one, right?
You are not. Of course, all this depends on where you're invested, who you're invested with. But let's look at a couple of examples for folks. Start with Dodge & Cox, very popular investment firm, second largest institutional holder of Fannie Mae stock, almost 120 million shares as of July 31st. Now, as of last Friday, the final trading day before all this happened, the company says that Fannie made up 0.7% of their balanced fund, a full percent of their stock fund, 1.7% of their global stock fund. So if you have any of those, you can do the math based on your own portfolio. Here's the kicker, though. They went on a Fannie spree recently. According to Morningstar, Dodge & Cox Stock Fund and Balanced Fund were the two top buyers of Fannie stock leading up to the end of the second quarter. And trust me, we were hearing word
right.
of problems there.
So what were these guys doing, these fund managers who were buying these companies?
Well, basically, they made the prediction that the government would ride to the rescue, that it would prop up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. What they didn't bet on was shareholders being the last in line in a government bailout.
What do, just to pick on them a little more, Dodge and Cox have to say about this?
They did put up a statement on their website, and if I may paraphrase, they said Fannie and Freddie said they had plenty of money.
Right.
Well, you know what? My mom said there was a tooth fairy.
Who else out there has been buying Fannie and Freddie?
Well, let's look at Fidelity, a mutual fund company close to us.
It manages our 403Bs.
And they are another investment firm that actually bought more Fannie stock as things were starting to get shaky. They added more than 10 million shares to their funds in the second quarter. That's 5% of Fannie's outstanding stock. And some of the funds that you'll find it in, Fidelity Equity Income, Fidelity Growth and Income, one familiar to you, Fidelity Balanced right. Fund, which, as you mentioned, shaved off $447 of your dollars.
Run down the list of the other top 10, though. I mean, Fidelity is well-known, Dodge & Cox, some of the others?
Oh, you've got Vanguard, you've got T. Rowe Price, Hancock Funds, all of them now left holding the bag on both Fannie and Freddie. And speaking of Freddie, on the Freddie side, we've been talking mostly about Fannie, Wellington, the biggest recent buyer there, and Legg Mason, 80 million shares, more than 12% of the company, also after a recent buying spree.
Very quickly, before we move on, who was smart enough to get out of Fannie and Freddie?
Well, Bloomberg did some research on that. We'll credit them, and they found that Oppenheimer sold off a whole bunch of Fannie and Freddie, and Capital World, which runs American funds, also sold off, but they still own 1.5% of the company.
Lots of names, as I mentioned. We'll have some links on our website, marketplace.org, if you want to do some research for yourself. Tess Vigeland hosts our personal finance program. It is called Marketplace Money, which is why we call her for fun stories like this. Tess, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
This next story falls into the category of problems we should all be so lucky to have. Scholastic, the publishing house, has sold more than 350 million Harry Potter books since the series started back in 1997. Profits were up 15% this past fiscal year, which included publication of Book 7, The Deathly Hallows. But it does leave the company having to answer this question. Now what are you going to do? One possible answer hits bookstores today, a new series called The 39 Clues. And Scholastic's gone all out. Books, a website, a movie deal with Steven Spielberg, and $100,000 in prize money for readers. But after Harry, is all that going to be enough to cast a spell over kids? From New York, Ashley Meltite reports.
The 39 Clues encompasses the books, a detailed website, and packs of trading cards, which are sold separately. David Levithan is executive editorial director at Scholastic. He says this project is a big departure for the company, but a necessary one.
We really saw that publishing is changing and that we wanted to fit the context of the times that our readers are living in.
Even if doing so means a lot more work than usual, he says authors and editors have to weave the evolving storyline between books, cards, and website.
One of the reasons it's taken 3 years for us is we had to choreograph everything from the beginning because everything has to interact with everything else.
Every hint dropped, every possible clue must fit. Scholastic is investing millions of dollars in the series. Katrina Fallon is an equity analyst with Citigroup. She says Scholastic is naturally looking for a successor to the Harry Potter series. But even if The 39 Clues is a hit with readers, it won't necessarily make Scholastic a hit with investors.
Wall Street demands revenue growth and earnings growth. And it just could take some time to actually see that in an environment when they're investing in their business to this extent.
Fallon says Scholastic stock is down from the Harry Potter days, about 30% since last summer. She says in a faltering economy, parents don't spend as much on books as usual. Still, she likes Scholastic's idea of encouraging kids to get involved with the story online and on the page. So does 9-year-old Rena McInerney.
Wow, that's really cool. I'd do that.
I met Rena at Books of Wonder in Manhattan. She was shopping with her mother, Kathleen.
Personally, I think the books are enough. But nowadays, it doesn't seem to be enough because everybody does everything on the web and you buy toys that are connected to a website.
Still, she says, as long as the series is educational and fun, she's in. Books of Wonder's owner, Peter Glassman, isn't so keen. He's not convinced about the whole multi-platform approach.
One of the nice things about having been a bookseller since 1975 is I've seen a lot of so-called cutting-edge things that turned out to be nothing more than trends. That the book as the book has survived and everything else has come and gone.
He says he doubts many publishers could afford to mount such multimedia extravaganzas on a regular basis. Kids who read the books, or their parents, will end up paying $12.99 per book and $6.99 for each pack of cards. In the Barnes & Noble Cafe, a few blocks from Books of Wonder, Lichelle Kameen and her daughter are cautiously enthusiastic.
Sounds very expensive. But I could see her going for something like that, most definitely.
13-year-old Aisha agrees. She says she loves mysteries. But she says she doesn't need cards or online extras to be drawn into an imaginary or recreated world. She says reading alone is pleasure enough.
It's a different feeling from like a game or a TV show. I don't get that feeling with that kind of stuff. It's actually kind of like I can't exactly tell you how the feeling is, but it's the greatest feeling ever.
She says she'll give the 39 clues a try after she's polished off a biography of John Adams. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming up, tuberculosis weakens Eastern Europe.
TB is not a medical problem. It's an economic problem. TB affects people between the ages of 19 and 55 years of age, those economically productive.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street fell back to earth with a thud today, led by Lehman Brothers. The Dow Industrials dove 2.4%, 280 points to close at 11,231. The Nasdaq gave back 2.2%, 59 points to finish at 2209. The S&P 500 surrendered 3.1%, 40 points, ended the day at 1227. Financials gave back all the gains they made yesterday. Lehman led the pack with that 44% loss that I told you about. Washington Mutual wasn't far behind, ending down nearly 20%. Citigroup slid 7%. Bank of America barrel down 6% today. Energy companies got burned as oil fell to $103 a barrel. Valero Energy bled 11%. Freeport McMoRan crumpled 9% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. And by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Wednesday. The Hudson Institute holds a conference to discuss the state of food issues around the world. Radio hosts kick off a two-day broadcasting event in Washington focused on immigration reform. And the annual Funniest Celebrity in Washington contest takes place. Politicians such as Mike Huckabee and other pundits and policymakers compete for the title. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
One of our most commented upon stories of the past couple of weeks came from the world of medicine, ancient Chinese medicine to be exact. We told you about a community acupuncture clinic in Philadelphia. Group sessions there are making the alternative treatment more affordable. But Patrick Pierce from San Diego, California, wasn't worried about the economics. He just didn't care much for the idea of acupuncture at all.
I noticed that the subject of whether acupuncture is truly medically effective was not addressed. Perhaps you should do more stories on pseudoscience, quackery, and fraud medicine, and the dangers they can pose both directly from injury and indirectly by convincing people to not see a credible doctor and properly treat their conditions.
That really struck a nerve in the comments section of our website. Pennsylvania graduate student Melanie Adley says that after a long day of slogging over her German homework, acupuncture works great on her stress.
For those who do yoga, it's almost like a very good yoga session. You feel like very calm, but a little energetic, and I felt totally sharp, which is not meant to be a pun.
Another story from the health world caught listeners' ears, too. We looked at the backlog of Social Security disability claims. Social worker Emily Axel from Astoria, New York, liked the piece, but she thought we left some people out of it.
One important aspect that was not mentioned in your story, however, are the individuals who apply for disability based on a mental health disorder. These applications are most certainly considered borderline and often incredibly difficult to have approved by administrative judges.
This fall's campaign was in the air over the past few weeks as both parties held their nominating conventions. We asked some of our commentators to tell us what the candidates weren't talking about, but should be. David Frum's take on immigration really steamed English language teacher Renee Kreisel.
His idea to implement an immigration policy like Canada's or Australia's, which favor highly skilled individuals, in the end treats people like things. As a wealthy nation, where even the poor are rich in comparison to the world's poorest, our immigration policy should be primarily humanitarian.
Commentator Will Marshall got a lot of letters, too, not for what he said about energy policy, but for how he said it.
But there's a missing element in the party's platform, and that's any discussion of the future of nuclear energy. In fact, nuclear power doesn't rate a single mention in 57 pages.
Nuclear. Sound familiar?
Nuclear weapons.
Not that this makes it right, but George Bush, Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, and Dwight Eisenhower have all pronounced nuclear at times as nuclear. Maybe this does make it right, though. Merriam-Webster recognizes both pronunciations. They'll send you a long explanation of why, if you ask. If you want to ask us anything, you know where to do it. Marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. For decades during the Cold War, Ukraine was probably best known as the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. Its crops helped feed the rest of that country. And farming is still important there. But since the breakup of the Soviet Union, Ukraine's earned another, less positive distinction. It's home to one of the largest pools of tuberculosis in the world. In the second part of our series on the resurgence of TB worldwide, Frank Browning has this report on private money and public health.
For 20 years, Mikhail, who at 71, worked in the mines around Donetsk. Then he became a plumber. A little over a year ago, his health began to fail.
During 3 months, June, July, and August, I felt myself bad. I was weak. I didn't want to eat. And I began to lose weight.
Mikhail spoke to me through a medical mask at the local TB hospital. He was being treated for multi-drug-resistant, or MDR-TB, which is especially virulent and hard to manage. Each year, more than 40,000 Ukrainians come down with TB, 16% of them with MDR-TB, giving Ukraine one of the worst MDR epidemics in the world. But now, Ukraine's richest, and some say shadiest, oligarch, Renat Akhmetov, is putting his own money into fighting the disease. Anatoly Zabolotny runs Akhmetov's Foundation for the Development of Ukraine.
We plan to spend $20 million for the next 5 years. We buy equipment, we buy medicine, we repair the tuberculosis hospitals. But at the same time, we change the medicine system, we make it more effective.
The idea is to engage business directly in rebuilding Ukraine's public health system.
Mostly businesses do not like to deal with tuberculosis, but we do.
One of the foundation's first projects was to measure public awareness of TB.
In Ukraine, we have epidemic for about 15 years, but only 28% of the population know about this.
Almost all adult population is infected with tuberculosis.
That's Katia Gametsinya, who directs training programs in Ukraine for PATH, a global company based in Seattle that promotes private participation in public health projects. Gametsinya says only 10% of those who carry TB bacteria are likely to get sick. But they are increasingly young men shooting IV drugs and infected with the AIDS virus. There's another problem. That's politics. A recent report from the World Health Organization cited bureaucratic wrangling between the old Soviet TB hierarchy and the current health ministry's HIV program as a major barrier to controlling the epidemic. The problem is compounded, says PATH's Katia Gametsinya, by general political instability.
I could not even tell you how many ministers of health used to work during my time at PATH, so it's probably, I don't know, 15 or more.
Vladimir Moscovy is the chief doctor in the Akhmetov Foundation's campaign. He says early diagnosis and keeping patients on treatment are key so they don't develop the more serious MDR-TB, which was rare in the old Soviet system.
The doctors could go and find out all patients with TB. Now, if someone doesn't want to be treated, he doesn't go to the hospital, and nobody worries about it.
In Donetsk, the foundation has actually taken over direct management of the TB program. That's in part, says Anatoly Zabolotny, because of chaos in the official public system, even down to the lack of patient registrations.
The Ministry of Health talking about the system for years, but nothing changed. And we have to create this system to get the real numbers, which doesn't exist. How many people were treated, how many people get healthy, how many people died.
At the World Health Organization, Marcos Espinal directs the Global Partnership Against TB, and he has tough words for Ukraine.
The main issue of Ukraine is the political commitment. TB is not a medical problem. It's an economic problem. TB affects people between the ages of 19 and 55 years of age, those economically productive. If we don't put that in the minds of the political leaders, then the problem will not be solved.
West Americans believe that they're protected by wealth and distance from Ukraine's troubles. But there are major Ukrainian communities in the United States. And these Ukrainian Americans visit their homeland all the time, sharing their health and their airborne illnesses with the whole world. In Donetsk, Ukraine, I'm Frank Browning for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
A couple of final thoughts today. The CEO of the New York Stock Exchange says he's thinking about the timing of when or maybe if to delist Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac shares from the big board. The two closed below a dollar today, traditionally the threshold for getting tossed. Those who might want to would still be able to trade the shares. They just have to do it someplace else, largely through a system known as the pink sheets. On a related note, there was some housing news today. Not terribly reassuring news, though. Pending home sales, that is, sales for which the contract has been signed, but the deal is not yet done. Anyway, those sales fell once again last month. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 280 points. That is 2.4%. The Nasdaq lost 59 points, 2.75%. The S&P 500 fell 40 points. That's 3.1% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, big money donors with a point of view.
People have sometimes been scared of gay. And so by putting it there in all these completely safe places, we kind of make the word innocuous.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy.
In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.